You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity, from rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Welcome to the very first episode of The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Laura.
And...
Ben. In this first episode, we'll be talking about Interstellar, which just happened to come out the same week we decided to start the podcast. We'll be sharing our thoughts about the film and talking about the science that inspired it and is embedded within it.
And Laura, you've got an interview for us, haven't you?
I do, yes. I interviewed Dr. Eric Stengler from University of the West of England. He's an astrophysicist and a science communicator. He had some particularly interesting things to say about wormholes, time as a fifth dimension, and how film and science fiction is shaping our society.
There will be spoilers for Interstellar all through the episode, so if you haven't seen the film and you're worried about being spoiled, press pause, get down to a cinema, preferably a nice big IMAX screen, watch the film and come back.
I suppose the best place to begin is with the genesis of the film Interstellar, which I think is quite interesting from the science point of view, because it started with Kip Thorne, who ended up as the executive producer on the film, putting a script together with the film producer, Linda Obst. Their goal was to create a film which was centred around and based on the hard science of wormholes, other dimensions, etc.
Yeah, I've got a quote from Kip Thorne here. For me, the thing I most wanted was that the film have real science embedded in it. A range of science from well-established truths to speculative science.
Interestingly, when I interviewed Dr. Eric Stengler, he had a great insight into the beginnings of the project.
So I happened to follow the project from very early on because I just happened to be in a conference where Kip Thorne was present and announced that he was toggling with the idea of putting this forward. And at that moment, he had Steven Spielberg on board, and therefore, of course, John Williams with the music. And, well, that was 4.5 years ago, and who would have thought that after 4.5 years, we would be talking about a blockbuster like Interstellar?
Exactly, yes. And the it was all surrounded by such a hype as well, with Christopher Nolan producing it, and there was high expectations of it. And do you think they've lived up to the expectations?
Very much so. I think in this case, the hype was perfectly justified.
Yes.
Because Christopher Nolan has proven before that he's just a magnificent filmmaker, and it's just almost a magician with storytelling in movies, with filmmaking. And he again was up to the expectations that he has set with his previous movies. He hasn't done many, but all of them are masterworks.
Yes,
definitely. So I think it was very lucky to have him taking up this idea. And it was also very lucky to have Kip Thorne on board and able to show Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan that something as abstract and difficult as relativity and black holes and time dilation and so on can be actually used in the storytelling of a movie rather than just a prop in the background of a movie, which where it had been used before.
But
you've seen black holes and wormholes in movies almost as a prop, not part of the story. The interesting thing of Interstellar is that the story hinges on the time dilation and on the distortion of space and time that black holes and relativity bring about. So it's an integral part of the story, and that's what makes it unique and special.
Well, there's an awful lot to talk about there. We'll get on to that. But Laura, were you looking forward to the screening when we went to it?
Absolutely. No, I particularly enjoyed the trailer. And with it being a Christopher Nolan film, there's also the associated hype that goes along with that. You expect it to be just as clever and just as beautifully done as his previous films.
I went into this as sort of as blind as I could and hadn't really thought about the fact that it was a Christopher Nolan film, if you like. But all I'd seen was initially this trailer.
That was the little teaser that they put out.
Yeah, and it was almost like an advert for NASA and interstellar travel. They cut together lots of Apollo footage, and the Matthew McConaughey character was doing the bit about, you know, we used to be explorers, but now we've just become caretakers, and we're explorers by nature, and we need to get back out amongst the stars. And I can't fail to be excited. I don't know how anybody can fail to be excited by a film that's positioning itself like that, really.
I just saw the second trailer, which was very much...
Yeah.
There was some stunning imagery, but a lot of it was the emotion and, you know, lots of Hans Zimmer...
feel this.
Yeah, yes,
absolutely.
Let's feel some stuff, and love is the most powerful force. And da-da-da. So I was a bit wary about it. It looked interesting, and obviously, yeah, I enjoyed Inception a lot. I know, Laura, you loved Inception.
Absolutely loved it. It's one of my favourite films. There's nothing I love more than the, oh, that makes sense, that moment in the film. That is my favourite part of Nolan's films.
When things just click
together.
Just
things click into place.
Yeah, you hope for something on that level. The kind of puzzle element, the cerebral element, but also really lovely physicality, like the way they did a lot of those dream sequence with real physical sets, like turning around, and that I think that's what I was hoping for from Interstellar. Yeah, there's times, certain films where that doesn't quite work, and maybe some people say that The Dark Knight Rises was a bit bloated, a bit unnecessary, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I disagree with them,
what
but they might
opinion?
Say
that's fair enough. Some might say. But The Dark Knight itself is incredible and a masterpiece of momentum, of barreling movement that just, once it gets going, never stops. You're kind of clinging on for dear life. And yeah, that's the kind of thing that, yeah, of course you have high expectations following those films.
If I'd known it was Christopher Nolan, I might have had my expectations tempered a little bit because of the Man of Steel thing, but let's not go there.
That's a whole other can of worms.
What's the Man of Steel thing, Andrew?
Enlighten us.
Okay, so the Man of Steel thing, if you've seen the film, you know what the Man of Steel thing is. And what the Man of Steel
thing is. That it's a terrible movie.
Yes.
Right.
Sorry, I completely forgot
the
penny right.
dropped.
Yeah, right, okay. And he was the producer of that. Yeah, okay,
yeah.
Got it.
So it's...
Yeah, we can move on.
Spoilers for Man of Steel, don't watch it. That's not a spoiler, that's going to make your life better.
That's just good advice for anyone out there. We've lost half the audience already.
Yeah.
Amy Adams is in it. I mean, that. As a one star.
So. She's all right.
The very great final hair. Scene, very, very last scene, is very good and should have been peppered throughout the whole film. We're talking about it!
Andrew has asked me to give a brief synopsis for Interstellar in the form of a haiku, so here goes. Corn for every meal. Dust stops even baseball games. But there's a wormhole.
It's quite a long film.
It's quite a long film.
You've done quite well to make it quite so succinct.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ben. That was very helpful. Unless you haven't seen the film, in which case that was disastrous.
I could do a blow-by-blow account, because I have seen it twice.
Yeah.
Maybe that can be a podcast extra.
Yeah.
Or a podcast.
Yeah. Just you talking to yourself about the film. That
Ben, what happened at the beginning? Well, yeah, if you remember, it started with the documentary section. So you see Ellen Bernstein there, and you think, oh, it's Ellen Bernstein in heavy makeup. And oh, but it's like a PBS doc, and there's some other older farmers.
Oh, it'd be amazing. You could sit in the shed and record the first bit, and then go into your room
and
talk to yourself. I think it's just worth having a look at a couple of things that we thought were really good about the film. Ben?
Okay, well, as I said, I was hoping for that kind of Inception... Dark Knight level of physicality, and they've really kind of delivered that. A lot of the spaceship, space station sets feel really authentic, really lived in. There's a lot of, you feel human contact bashing against them. You feel the actors kind of living in these sets. There's a lovely shot which is repeated throughout the film of a camera strapped to one of the Ranger ships, and you can just feel it shaking as it's kind of flying along. So yeah, I really enjoyed the physicality. It's a ton of different films kind of smashed together. It's obviously an interstellar travel film. It's a film about wormholes. It's a film about fathers and daughters. It's a kind of Dust Bowl, Depression era drama. It's quite a neat, like, closed loop time travel film. And I think that's, yeah, it's great. It's ambitious. For me, it was the kind of the final section of the film that things really got going and the momentum really kind of kicked in from the point where Matt Damon exited the film. No offense to Matt Damon, but the point where his character Dr. Mann gets blown out of the airlock, and then, you know, things just really start barreling forward. They reach the Tesseract and everything kind of clicks into place with the time loop. I thought that was all beautifully done.
I love that you have the science fiction aspect of it, and it was made so much more believable by adding the emotion in and the relationships. And I particularly enjoyed where time was described as a fifth dimension. Cooper was flying through the fifth dimension trying to get a young Murph's attention, and he's running through these series of rooms. It's the same room over and over again, trying to get Murph's attention through the bookcase, and books are falling on the floor. And I just think it's so, so well done.
And the kind of mix of CGI and nice sort of practical effects at that point. We had the sort of gauze effect looking through the bookcases, the lighting.
Yeah.
It was really beautifully realised.
And you were really rooting for him. You've really wanted him to break through that barrier.
That mix of the authentic real sets that they're on, and this stunning CGI footage of, or stunning CGI images of wormholes and the fifth dimension, is absolutely breathtaking stuff. But for me, seeing Endurance cross Saturn on that massive screen was, I hesitate to say this, but it was out of this world. It was incredible. There's a bit in Sunshine, Danny Boyle's film, where they're travelling towards the sun and Mercury transits across the sun, and they're all sitting on the spacecraft looking at this astronomical event. And that's one of my favourite moments in cinema history, because, you know, being an astronomer, just to be able to see that on that massive scale is fantastic. And both that and Interstellar. I don't know if it is actually the Cassini imagery that they've used there, you know, Cassini, this spacecraft that's orbiting around Saturn and looking at its moons and doing an amazing amount of science, but also taking these stunning images, which you haven't seen. If you haven't seen, just Google Cassini imagery. It's unbelievably brilliant.
Stick them on the website.
Oh yeah, I'll put them on the website, definitely.
With the Endurance just completely dwarfed by Saturn, just floating across.
Yeah,
it's beautiful perspective.
I honestly would sit and watch that for 3 hours, just looking at Saturn for 3 hours on a screen that big. It's just amazing.
Can we do a podcast of your reaction for 3 hours? How long can you say wow for wow?
Yeah, amazing.
A particular scene in the film that is stuck with me is when Matt Damon is
the, we love Matt Damon.
We love him, but he's blasted.
Only when he dies.
I really like that there's all this drama, this build up, the noise, the devastation, and then as he's blasted into space, silence.
Oh.
Nothing. And you just watch the wreckage and the debris just going into space, and the whole cinema's sitting there shell-shocked.
You see the Endurance from above, I suppose, with the ice planet, but it's kind of silhouetted against the ice planet, and the debris sort of flying out.
Yeah. It's incredible to look at, and it's funny, actually. I think I went to it, as I've said, I went to it because I wanted to see a film about space, and I loved that. And since seeing it, I've been fascinated reading about all the science behind it and all the disagreements and arguments online between scientists, etc. But the reason I actually love the film is the relationship between the father and daughter, Murph and Cooper. It is beautifully portrayed. It really is. I love it.
It's real emotional. Really emotional stuff.
And very well played.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, we're in the middle of the reconnaissance. possibly at the later stages. I think by this point, you know, we're all behind him.
Yeah.
I've been
with him since Contact, to be honest. I've never lost him.
Yeah. Absolutely. Lone Star was a long time ago. Anyway, he does do a great job, and Mackenzie Foy, who plays the younger Murph, is absolutely fantastic.
She's
and they
brilliant.
They spend a lot of time at the in the first act, really building up that relationship, but it completely pays off.
Yeah.
A particularly a favourite line in the film is when Mirth is sure that there is a ghost in her room, and she runs to Cooper, her father. She was like, "There's a ghost, there's a ghost." And basically, he turns around and says, "Prove it.
Yeah.
Form a hypothesis, test it, and find out what is causing this, whether it's a ghost." And I think that's so nice that he's instilling that scientific inquisitiveness at such a young age.
Yeah.
And then she grows up to become a scientist.
Yeah.
And she works on the same project.
Yeah. I think that's...
And saves the world.
And saves the world, yeah. Yes.
And as science communicators, isn't it brilliant to see the scientific method portrayed on the big screen in such a big film, so early on, and just to see that way of thinking in such a mainstream movie, it's just, I mean, basically we can retire, can't we?
Oh, that's it, job done. Job, absolutely. But I think that goes on to, in the interview with Dr. Eric, and talking about how a film is integrated into society.
I just wanted to show ways in which this can go beyond using films as an educational tool. I've done it myself, both in education and also in outreach and in popular science. You use film clips to illustrate a concept. Sometimes you show things that are not accurately portrayed and use that to explain how it should have been.
Oh, right.
And
yeah,
that's a fair use of that. I'm not criticizing the movie maker for that. I'm just using it as a tool. But I think from the point of view of science communication, this relationship between science and films is more than just that. That's already a good thing and a very useful way of relating science to film. But there's more to that. And it's all related to how movies depict science, how they provide a channel between science and society. I'm always thinking of the possibility that science as depicted in film is not only a way in which the scientific establishment and the filmmaker can try to influence how people think about science. Sometimes, or maybe more often than not, I would say that films are a representation of what society thinks about science, because the filmmakers are part of society. So they very often, I think, would actually rather represent society in this dialogue between science and society than science.
And I really liked that. I hadn't thought about it like that before.
All right, well, let's move on to what we didn't like about the film, shall we?
Okay,
so I have to start with the music. It's really my only problem with the film is the music, and it's a Hans Zimmer soundtrack. We could go back to Man of Steel if we want at this point.
No!
No, no tangents.
Right, okay, so just to state the what I would have thought would be blindingly obvious, but obviously isn't to Hans Zimmer and Christopher Nolan, good music in a film takes the audience with the narrative. It doesn't come blasting out of the screen and be apparently utterly irrelevant. And this film does that only on a few occasions. There's three or four occasions where it's almost as if somebody's playing a stereo off screen in their office that has nothing to do with the conversation that's going on. And it jarred me out of the film. You know, it's an engrossing film that takes you on a journey for 3 hours. And I was knocked out of that journey three or four times by the music.
Who would you have chosen as the composer?
Well, it's interesting what Eric Stengler said, wasn't it? That originally, when it was a Steven Spielberg film, it was John Williams.
So if we could have got the Nolan and the John Williams together.
Oh, come on.
I feel a letter coming on.
But that goes, they would do it, that's Man of Steel again, isn't it? Because Superman has this incredible theme. And then Hans Zimmer comes along and goes, no, we won't have any music, we'll just have explosions and bangs. And oh, it's awful.
There is a kind of Spielbergian sort of feeling to the film, which is, I was surprised by. The film is pretty optimistic about our ability to kind of move forward as a species. And even in the earlier sequences, the kind of apocalyptic vision is quite an optimistic one.
I think it's good to see a future where it's not the kind of dystopian future of Mad Max, etc. It's just it's a community of people making the best of the world that they're in, with just NASA secretly trying to get back out of space.
It's interesting to think about what this film would have been like as a Spielberg, as a kind of Close Encounters too.
Oh, amazing.
There aren't actually any aliens after all. Oh, whoops. it's just some guy.
He woke up.
But and also it does have that kind of... It did remind me of Signs.
Okay. Yeah,
especially at the start.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I agree.
In the cornfield and kind of thinking about the ghosts.
I didn't like the water planet. That was...
The first planet they visit.
And I just feel that you have a water planet and you have a cold, barren, Arctic planet. And if there's land on another planet, it would have been the jungle planet. And it was just so, like, too good to be true that they landed on water that they could stand in, and then along comes a big crashing wave and they lose a crew member. And it just feels... like it was the link to the next stage of the film. They had to kill the crew member off. This is how they did it, and they moved on. And I don't think it was particularly, for want of a better word, believable, or I don't think it fitted in with the rest of the film.
Okay.
But I think
you're
disagree.
Wrong, but that's fine.
Yes, I'm wrong.
And then they move on to the ice planet.
Yes.
Where it's basically an episode of Star Trek, the original series. Mm.
So it's brilliant.
Absolutely.
Was really good.
Untouchable. you land on the ice planet. Of course, there's the guy there who's been there. He's cut off from civilization. He's gone a little bit stir crazy. He's gone space crazy.
Yeah.
This is another point which wasn't helped by the music. Some very obvious kind of cues on the soundtrack that this guy isn't to be trusted.
Mm.
The robot Kip is lying broken in the corner. Dun, dun. And I didn't really...
Does it actually go dun, dun?
It might as well. Might as well have been a close-up on his eye and just beat it. And the world itself, quite nicely realised with the solid clouds and everything kind of folding in on itself.
Mm.
I didn't find much really interesting to do on that world. It might as well have just been William Shatner and the guest star of the week duking it out in the quarry.
Amazing, yeah, that would have been true. Perfect.
Well, that would have been way better.
What got me was the stereotype. He was just standing on his fingers to make him drop off the slope. Just standing
it
on
didn't feel like they'd really push that as far as it could have gone. It was, yeah.
Maybe it was a one take scene.
yeah, they didn't have. They only had a day in Iceland to do that. The beginning scenes on the Earth, although I sort of enjoyed them. Again, the music, when they're going through the cornfield, they're not doing much, but there's massive music. And then the music goes...
crash, crash, crash!
And he's looking out onto a field.
I read a really good article today about the music in the film.
Oh, gosh.
And it was titled, "You Can't Hear Anything in Space." And that was it.
Great.
And it was all basically that you cannot hear the characters because Hans Zimmer is crashing and banging over the top of the whole film.
Oh, dear.
But there was some good things about those early sequences. It did feel long, but then they got them into space pretty quickly, really.
Yeah.
The middle section, for me, was the weakest. It just felt like they had these massive stakes. The Earth is dying. They couldn't find the stakes for the individual scenes. The water planet, it was murky. Like, why do they have to go down to retrieve this black box or whatever it was? It just didn't feel like there was much drama at that stage. The ice planet, there's some nice speeches.
Family and flashing before your eyes as you...
Yeah,
as you
that, that we can't
moment.
Empathise with anyone beyond our kind of immediate circle. And da, da, da. But really, it just needed to get him in that airlock that we love so much, blast him out.
Yeah.
And from that point on, brilliant. But up until then, it felt stodgy. It felt like they were kind of really groping around for some drama that just never quite happened.
I don't know. I'm going to have to disagree with you. But I think that's okay.
That's why we're here.
Exactly. Can we boo them?
Exoplanets is a particular interest of mine. So any portrayal of a, of a planet that could possibly exist.
Yes.
To see that in a film, I'm happy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm easily pleased.
But we have just established that you'd watch Saturn for 3 hours.
Exactly, yes.
Nothing happened.
Yeah, true. Granted.
Do you get out much?
Not really. No, I just sit in my shed and talk about stuff. Thanks for coming to join me for that. That's really good.
We're really sorry for interrupting your Saturn viewing.
So
we know you only get 3 hours a day.
They do talk about the reasons for human spaceflight, which, you know, is one of the reasons for the film, isn't it? Well,
it's propaganda for the space program, really. Yeah. Which is great.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Every film should be propaganda for the space program. I mean, I don't mean that. Obviously, there could be
the latest chick flick.
No, we don't need that. There could be films that were propaganda for CERN and the Large Hadron Collider.
Mm.
That'd be another good thing. But basically, those two types of films, and we're happy.
Yeah, just following up from what Laura's saying about the Murph character, brilliant that it kind of sets up Murph on the scientific journey. Did you feel that was kind of followed through with the Anne Hathaway character, Bran? She's obviously introduced as a brilliant scientist. Her arc, for me, was a little unfortunate, particularly the scene where Bran is arguing with Cooper about which planet to visit next. A few people have kind of mentioned it to me that was the point where they just kind of felt really disappointed with the film. It sets up this brilliant, brilliant scientist, and then, oh, of course, she's a woman, so she's just... Woman has feelings, man is objective. Cooper is kind of the voice of reason, and it just felt a bit trite at that point.
But was he the voice of reason? That's the... It could be portrayed that there was either a method in his madness as to why he wanted to go the opposite, or she wanted to go and visit the man she'd fallen in love with, and he was saying that he wanted to go. It did come across that he was just being...
Yeah, I think the intention of the scene was to show that they were both kind of grappling around for something, but the way it kind of came across was very much, and partly it's to do with Matthew McConaughey just being a bit too charming.
Yes.
So we kind of go with him, and maybe the film could have undercut that a bit, could have pushed his character a little bit further into entitled white male behaviour, basically. But it feels a bit soft at that point. And you cut, I don't know, that has been a reaction of quite a few people who I've spoken to about the film.
That's fine, I understand that, but I didn't see it like that at all. I just saw it as his character getting it badly wrong. I didn't see him in that scene as being the one who got it right.
Oh, absolutely. And he goes through a journey. You could definitely read the film as basically him needing to explore his feminine side.
Him wanting to go home, or wanted to return home, that was his love. That was his love for Murph. That was his love for his son. That he wanted to go home. And her love for this man, and that's what was pulling them apart. It was love for both of them. So it was the emotion for both of them.
I think that scene just felt trite, and there were other ways that they could have found those intentions. Perhaps it was just, you know, the need to kind of create tension, to create drama. It didn't come across in a very organic way. Another example, later on in the film, where Jessica Chastain, as Murph, is trying to get her brother's family out of the house, it just kind of immediately kind of escalated, like, oh, the kid's got a cough, he needs to go now, we need to get them out, just to create the... It just felt really inorganic for me.
It's almost as if it was convenient just to move on to the next stage of the film.
A small problem with sort of diversity in the film. It was a shame that we didn't see a bit more of the world, really. We only really saw America, and a pretty white version of America. They had the perfect opportunity with the kind of PBS talking head documentary at the beginning, and the final scenes in the ultra-futuristic space station. Just a shame they couldn't bring a little bit more diversity.
Let's look at the science.
One of the major positives that's come out of Interstellar, and it's helped visualise what a wormhole would look like for the first time. And Erik Stengler has clarified this for us.
So wormholes are a mathematical concept that can be constructed theoretically and that links two black holes that are in a very different parts of the universe and also at different times maybe.
Okay.
So there would be a pathway from one to the other, which means they would allow to travel mathematically from one point in space and time to another point in space and time. Now, I emphasize the mathematical bit because, of course, we haven't seen any wormhole around there. It's just a mathematical possibility. But this links into the debate that's been going on forever about whether everything that's mathematically possible actually has a correspondence in reality or not, because mathematics, after all, is a tool to describe the physical reality, and maybe you don't have to believe that everything that's possible in the mathematical universe has its corresponding reality in the physical world. In that in that sense, if you can calculate and make wormholes work in theory through mathematics, that doesn't necessarily mean that they exist.
What's your personal opinion of the use of them in films? Are they depicted, in your term, in your eyes, accurately?
Well, there's two sides to that. I mean, films are an exercise in storytelling.
Yes.
When we go to watch films, we don't want to see documentaries or factual programs. We want to see a story nicely told.
Yes, that's
so
true.
In that sense, wormholes are a fantastic tool to make stories work because they open up a lot of possibilities in storytelling, which bring you across time and space in ways that weren't possible before. Of course, you can do it in a fantastic way, by magic, and any filmmaker would be happy to do that. But if you have a link to real science, it makes things more believable. And therefore, as I say, the concept of wormholes are a nice tool for that. So regardless of whether they are actually depicted accurately or not, I think it's a very good idea that they are being used to describe time travel or travel across the universe at speeds that exceed the speed of light for storytelling purposes. That's fine. Yes. The other side of it is on whether they are accurate or not. And I think that in general, it's not very important whether the scientific objects or processes or elements are depicted accurately in movies. In fact, there are lots of web pages and people who write books about whether the science in movies is accurate or not. And for example, with Interstellar, it didn't take long for blogs and web pages to come up criticizing some apparent inaccuracies in the movie. And I think that's a very poor approach to science in film, because it's not about depicting things accurately. The real interesting way in which science can interact with filmmaking is in helping filmmakers to make better stories. And that's the way in which science will be actually drawn into filmmaking more and more. Not if scientists come up after every science fiction movie and start bashing at the movie because of its apparent inaccuracies. Yeah. I always make the comparison, medical science or hospitals, laws, attorneys and judges, sports or the world of music, none of them is depicted absolutely accurately in movies, and you don't see musicians and hospital people and lawyers up in arms about the inaccuracies in film, because films are not about accuracy, it's about storytelling.
Oh, that's really nicely put. I think that's the controversy with science fiction. Where does the science stop and where does the fiction begin, isn't
it? My short answer to that is I don't care.
I don't care, as long as you enjoy it. I completely agree.
Yes,
completely.
And I think Interstellar is a fantastic example of this collaboration.
Well said, Eric. Absolutely spot on. It's kind of where we're all coming from, isn't it? It's all about storytelling, and where there's a quote from Christopher Nolan, actually, where they put Kip Thorne's data and formulas and into these massive computers to generate the CGI of what the wormhole would look like, so to make it as real as possible. And I think Christopher Nolan kind of hit the nail on the head and why he's such a good storyteller. We wanted it to be realistic, but if it hadn't looked right to the audience, we would have changed it. And that's it, isn't it? You don't make it scientifically accurate and then it doesn't work as a story. The science comes second in that sense. As a filmmaker, the story comes first.
Absolutely.
The science is incredibly important in this film. And I think that's one of the things about this film which is particularly special from a science communication point of view, is that it's the science is central to the story. It's not kind of a side event.
It's not just insert science here.
Yeah. The nitpicking of the science is not something we're going to do here. I take what Eric says, it's a bad way of doing the science communication, and I think that's a really good point that he makes, that if every time a science fiction film comes out, the scientists just nitpick the science, then people won't want to make science fiction
films. It's been a trend recently. We saw it with Gravity, Neil deGrasse Tyson. There are times, perhaps, when that is relevant.
When
both things kind of break down, when the storytelling and the science break down. Then that's a problem. It's creating a set of rules within the story. As long as the rules are consistent within the film, that's what we grasp onto as audience members.
Absolutely.
It's turned out really well in the fact that it's actually, for the first time, it's helped visualise what a wormhole would actually look like.
It's brilliant that these physicists Kip Thorne's data has been put into these massive computers that they use to make these films. And so for the first time, they've been able to visualise and actually generate the simulation of what the wormhole would look like. And as a result of that, they've got scientific papers. There's bits of the stars around where the gravitational lensing, where the light is being bent around the wormhole, where there's stars next to each other, where one's is stationary and other's being bent in all directions. Not in all directions, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And that they can actually, as a result of that... As a result of making that film, we understand more about wormholes. I mean, that is incredible, isn't it? I can't think of that ever happening before.
It's a two-way street. It's a two-way communication. The film has actually been used as a resource for scientists as well, not just
absolutely. The public. I don't suppose they set out to do that.
No, I think it's a great byproduct.
But I think we should now, as a result of that, we should now, from now on, any film that's made should add something to science. What do you think?
That sounds great.
Yeah.
That sounds brilliant.
Great. How's Saturn?
Just as
fair point.
As an example of what you were just talking about, the interview with Kip Thorne and Christopher Nolan from Wired. Kip Thorne said, "Chris wanted a planet with time dilation unbelievably greater than I've ever seen in physics. And I just didn't think that was possible." And he said, basically, "I gotta have it." I don't know how.
That's great.
Yeah. "I went home, slept on it, did a calculation, and found that if you have a black hole that spins rapidly enough and a planet that's very close to the last stable circular orbit, you could get the time dilation he wanted. It just amazed me."
That's brilliant. You know, so Christopher Nolan wants something, so he gets a theoretical physicist to go and work out how it could possibly happen. I don't suppose if he couldn't make it happen, it would have changed it. They would have just made it not believable, not made it scientifically accurate. But I just love that. I mean, that is...
Well,
just...
and the idea that the science can then spark off ideas for the storytelling, that's a lovely process.
There's been an awful lot of debate among scientists. The fact that there's an awful lot of debate going on, even between scientists, about the accuracy of the science in this. So there's a film that's been made, which has furthered science, the scientific papers about it. The public are talking about aspects of quite hard science, you know, dimensions and wormholes. The media are talking about it. I think it's brilliant. I think from a science communication point of view, it doesn't get better than this from films. Yeah.
Rather than just having science as Eric put it in the interview, as a prop, the fact that the film centres on science, that is an excellent form of science communication. It's an excellent way to get people talking, and I completely agree.
It's doing it, and it's doing it really, really well. If you went to the Guardian homepage, you know, at the top of the page was the science of Interstellar, the Telegraph's the same thing. Popping up on Twitter and Facebook and everything, everybody's talking about the science of it.
Kip Thorne's got a book called The Science of Interstellar.
Yeah. There's an awful lot of stuff that's written about the science of it, and some of it is interesting and some of it isn't. I will post a few links on the website. There's a Q&A with Kip Thorne on nature.com, which is great. If you really want to look at where the arguments are around the wormholes and things between the different astrophysicists and theoretical physicists, Dr. Ikyot Singh Kohli's blog, It's brilliant. It's got all the formulas and everything. He says, he actually says on there, I wrestled with myself whether to write this blog post or not. It's very good that he did, but we're not going to go into it here. What we are going to go into is dimensions. And I think, didn't you ask Eric about that?
I did, yes.
Well, yes, dimensions are, again, just a mathematical device to describe reality. And it happens to be that in order to describe space and time as a unity, relativity needed four dimensions. And then people keep adding dimensions as needed in order to make things work. For example, string theory, which tries to unify relativity with quantum mechanics, which is one of the holy grails of physics, postulates 11 dimensions to do that. Now, there is always the objection to that where do you stop? Do you just add a dimension until things work? Is that the correct approach, or is it fair to do that? Because again, you may add dimensions mathematically to make things work, because each time you add a dimension, you gain degrees of freedom where you can sort of do what you want that didn't work with one dimension less.
I see, yes.
And is it cheating? Because where do you stop adding dimensions until things work? Because all those dimensions you are adding, how do you later check whether they exist in reality? You can just try to explain them away and saying they are wrapped up in minute space and you cannot detect them. But that may as well be the way that nature works. I'm just flagging up the objections that some people may express against this multidimensional approach to things.
Yes.
So basically, right now we've got the four dimensions of space-time that relativity describes, which are more or less standard now.
Yes.
And then you've got further dimensions that quantum theory and the attempts to unify quantum theory with relativity bring about in the level of theory, which are still to be confirmed and tested experimentally.
Lovely stuff again from Eric. There's a chapter in Carl Sagan's Contact. There's a part in it which describes how we live in a universe which isn't as we grasp it, isn't as we see it. And the way he does it is just absolutely brilliant. But there are other ways that people have done it. I think there's, if you think of an ant walking along a piece of paper, it sees that as an entirely two-dimensional thing. Is not aware of the third dimension. It doesn't live in a three-dimensional world. It lives in a two-dimensional world from its point of view. But we can see that it's living in a three-dimensional world. So there's no reason why we can't be living in a three-dimensional world, which actually isn't a three-dimensional world at all. It could be an 11-dimensional world, and it's just that we don't perceive it. There could be, and the mathematics works in such a way to suggest that there are all these other dimensions that we have no idea that are there, but they're there all around us at the same time.
And there are lots of conversations throughout Interstellar about that idea.
Yeah.
Most of it from the perspective of there are these fifth dimensional beings kind of looking in on us and they're helping us. How did you feel about those beings going through the film?
Yeah, it's just a massive relief at the end when it's not just a massive relief. It's brilliantly done, and it just comes round. The whole thing comes round, and it's everything.
At the point where you see Tars going into the black hole, crossing the event horizon, that's when it all kind of clicked in place. That's when the puzzle, or whatever you want to call it, really sort of comes together. And that's when you go, okay, good. There's no aliens in this film. It didn't feel right from the beginning. It didn't feel, as I said, it felt like signs. So yeah, it all kind of comes together.
Yeah. Okay, we're nearly running out of time, so let's hear a bit more from Eric.
It is correct to think that it is important, for example, how science have been depicted, and scientists, the figure of the scientist has been depicted in movies in different times, and how it has changed and it has evolved from the mad scientist doctor from Back to the Future to the hero of CSI. It has evolved and it has changed. and how this actually influences people, because we can't deny the power of influence of movies in society.
Yeah.
But I think this other element, this consideration of movies as a voice of the society about concerns that society may have with science, that has been understudied, and I think that needs to be studied in the future.
That leads on very nicely to what we'll talk about next week, actually. But first, final thoughts on Interstellar?
I enjoyed the experience both times. I think there's a lot to enjoy. I kind of wish the middle section had been worked through a bit more, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think I would definitely see it again. I would say it's a must-see.
Oh, completely. I'll be getting out on Blu-ray, projecting it onto my wall and trying to work out a way of getting the music off.
That might be a special feature. Yeah,
that'd be amazing, wouldn't it? It's like Blu-ray special feature. Choose your own John Williams soundtrack.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Let's do that. That's just about it. There's our first podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you'll join us again. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at The Cosmic Shed. We're on Facebook. Look for us. There's other things called Cosmic Shed, but you'll recognise us by the lovely picture of a shed in space. Or have a look at the cosmicshed.com website. As I said, I'll be posting some notes there. Next week, I can't quite believe I'm going to say this, but next week we're covering The Imitation Game. I can believe I'm going to say that, but we actually have an interview with Benedict Cumberbatch. So join us for that. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Laura is so excited about Benedict Cumberbatch.
I am speechless.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
See you next week.
I know, it's ridiculous.
Just the thought.
Wait till you hear we've got an episode 3, seriously.
I'm never speechless.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.